Many people thought the Share Your Embarrassment tour was over, but it was just dormant. We are really excited to announce that right now, tickets are on sale for the streaming Cyboctacular. We filmed our Hollywood show last year, and it's going to be streaming starting May 16th and available for a couple of weeks after that to anyone that holds a ticket. And if you have a Max Fun membership, you can get your ticket at a discount. Just check your inbox for an email for Max Fun with that code. If you aren't and would like to see the show, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets today. These shows are really fun. We put a lot of work into high-quality production values. And if you get a VIP ticket, we can even meet face-to-face over the internet. Get your tickets today at greatestgentour.com, and we'll see you on May 16th.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet.
Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard, the U.S.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, the Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation, a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica. Ben, I've been feeling lately like something is missing from my life.
Oh, no. You got an Ira Stephen Bear shaped hole in your soul?
Yeah, I just I sit in the dark and then I look in the corner and then I see Ira Stephen Bear like hold his hands out. And in those
and
hands,
there was only one set of footprints. It was because Ira Stephen Bear was carrying you.
Yeah. When I couldn't get a word in edgewise, it was Ira Stephen Bear cutting me off.
Good to see you all in church.
It's called the Bible.
That's the way God wants it. I don't know why, dude.
All these questions? Is a little blind faith too much to ask?
It's been a while since we've done a Deep Space Nine Bible study, Ben. And being that this episode is so Miles O'Brien-centric, I thought I might read to you from the chapter about him.
Wow, I like this. I like this liturgical turn to get to the bottom of this character.
All right, Ben. Here is the reading. Miles O'Brien. O'Brien has been the transporter chief on STTNG for 5 years. This assignment represents a promotion to Master Chief of Operations, and a tremendous career opportunity for him. He's an Irishman, a mansman. With a down-to-earth quality, he's organized, efficient, and smart, and knows the hardware as well as any man in the fleet. He loves his work. He has a wife, Keiko, and a 3-year-old baby girl, Molly. He will be in charge of the comings and goings of vessels, plus the nuts and bolts maintenance of the station. He's constantly frustrated by the jerry-rigged way this thing is put together.
The comings and goings thing, I feel like they don't... They kind of went astray from, right? I don't get the sense that he's like...
Yeah, he's not like the greeter like Riker was.
No, and he's not like air traffic control either. Like, I feel like Dax and Kira are often doing that work.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of differences between the show Bible character outlines and what we get in the show. I think that's a good example of that here.
Well, I mean, and I think that that's like something that's interesting about the difference between TNG and DS9 is like that show Bible basically worked for TNG like all the way through. But mm-hmm. You write a show Bible at the beginning of Deep Space Nine and it's out of date at this point.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Like the characters have changed.
This is the King James version. Man, stuff done changed. Before he joined the crew of the Enterprise, he served aboard the USS Rutledge along the Cardassian border during territorial disputes that led to bitter fighting. He saw Cardassians commit unspeakable atrocities and lost close friends in the massacre at Setlik 3. The war changed him, hardened him. The first man he ever killed was a Cardassian who jumped him on patrol.
Wow.
As he tells the story to another Cardassian in the STTNG episode The Wounded, he says, "I'd never killed anything before. When I was a kid, I would worry about having to swat a mosquito."
It's not you I hate, Cardassian. I hate what I became because of you.
Yeah, so ends the reading, Ben.
I like that, that's a quote that we have come back to many times, and I like that that's in the Bible. That makes me feel like us bringing it up was intentional on the part of the writers.
I would say that the idea of Hard O'Brien is in dispute up until now, but maybe this episode will do something about that. You want to just get into it, Ben?
Let us get into it.
As we talk about Deep Space Nine, Season 4, Episode 18, Hard Time.
Do you realize how incredible this is? No, of course you don't.
It's Old Brian, Adam. Not O'Brien, it's Old Brian.
It's Unabomber O'Brien.
It is Spider Hole Saddam Hussein O'Brien.
How long do you think it would take for your hair and beard to get this way? Because we are told this is 20 years of O'Brien aging to get the Moses look.
I think I could probably get there in 20 years. It'd probably take you like 40 or 50, right?
It would take me 20 years to get to your 5 o'clock shadow. It just seems like it's weird for me to watch the scene and think of it as aspirational.
Yeah.
That's not what the tone is here.
It's something that I always have to think about because I do not have much of a beard. Like my beard is quite patchy compared to most, I would say. But compared to yours, it is full and thick.
Lustrous, even.
But you have a great big dick and I don't, so, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's also my inability to grow hair down there.
Oh, so it's an optical thing? It just looks big because there's not much to compare it to?
Exactly.
He's in an alien cell. Feels very, very similar to the type of cell that Riker was in that episode where Riker was in a play but also in jail.
Right.
Starting to lose track. And he's doing like a design on the floor, and then there's a Starship Mine style Verdion sweep, and it wipes the floor clean, and he starts over.
I bet if you're in production on this episode, you wish it were that easy, because like I thought a lot about this during the episode. Like when you work in a sandy environment, the continuity is a fucking nightmare because you've got people walking around the set.
Yeah.
Like, I imagine it takes some time. Like you're setting Colomini in the middle of the scene, you're lighting it, and then you're sweeping everything before you start rolling.
I don't like sand.
Sand and snow present a big challenge to shoot on for sure. One thing that you talk about when you're on a set that is like that is dressed, a set with props and things on it, is it's a hot set.
Yeah.
And so unless you're a prop or an actor that's actively performing something in the scene, you don't touch anything because a computer screen moving might fuck up continuity from one shot to the next. And if you're like a lighting guy and you need to like get at something, like you actually like bring somebody from that department over to like move something if you need it moved temporarily.
Colomini is like sitting on a hot set. He's on the hot lava. He can't touch it, but for a very specific way.
Yeah. And we'll come to understand this this design that he's doing, but not yet. We have him kind of shaky, seeming very disoriented, and then the doors to this cell open, and in walk a couple of green loafy aliens, the likes of which we have never seen before. And they announce that the Agrathi Authority has decided that he has reformed, that his prison sentence is up. They say he's free to go, and he kind of, you know, like the camera cuts back to him, and he's like, "No, I don't want to. Like, this is where I live. This, you know, he's Brooks in Shawshank. You know, he does not want to get a job bagging groceries in some town that he doesn't understand. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't want to return to a world that's gotten itself in a big damn hurry.
You definitely get the sense of this later on when he's constantly asking Ben Sisko to piss. You don't need to ask, O'Brien. You can just go.
But so he wakes up, and the room is very similar to the cell he was in, but just like a little cleaner and a little bit more, there's like a wall sconce that wasn't there before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not sand on the floor. It's like a hard floor. But he's been in some kind of clip show device.
A clip show device in a German wheel, like from a circus.
Yeah.
What do you make of this prop? This is great.
I don't know. Yeah. I wondered why the big hoop. Like,
yeah,
it must serve some function.
Yeah.
We don't get any exposition on what that might be, though.
No.
So, Kira is the familiar face that's there to welcome him back to reality. And what we come to understand is that the Agrathi are some kind of G-Quad creeps who convicted O'Brien of a crime and subjected him to 20 years in jail via a mental simulation. So this is, from his perspective, he's been in jail for 20 years, but, you know, it's only been a couple hours since the sentence was handed down in real time. So he's kind of waking up like a much younger man in a world that hasn't gone through what he's gone through.
I really like that it's Kira in this scene. Like, what you don't get is the scene before where Sisko makes a decision about who to send to go pick up O'Brien. And I've got to believe that there was a lot of thought about who would be best in this role. And Kira, for having been through the shit that she's been through, like, there are a lot of similarities between Kira and O'Brien, and we don't get a lot of them together up until this point in the show. But great choice to send her, because she is a great combination of someone who's been in the shit, but someone who is also, like, can be extremely gentle and shows great empathy for people in a way. Like her bedside manner with him, I think, is perfect in her scenes.
It's as good as anybody's and maybe better than anybody's compared to, I mean, because everybody knows that he's been through some trauma, and she maybe has like the best approach to dealing with him.
It wasn't real.
It's real to me, Major.
Yeah, and so she puts him on a runabout and takes him back home, and he is not right.
Gul Dukat. So
everybody is aware that he's going to have some reintegration to do. We have a brief scene with Sisko and Keiko. Sisko's kind of like explaining what happened and prepping her for receiving a husband who is fairly badly damaged compared to the one that departed a few days ago.
Keiko is the viewer proxy here instrumentally.
But Miles would never break the law intentionally.
I know that.
Because she's asking a lot of questions, and Sisko is giving all of this backstory to her and us.
And I guess the deal is that they have a sort of justice style of criminal justice on Agrath, where they decided that he committed a crime that to us seems like not a crime, and they convicted and punished him before anybody knew what had happened, without rocking an ounce of neck the entire time.
It's always sad, now doubly so.
How does this not mean war? Sisko is pretty chill talking about how the Argathans just sort of put him on trial immediately and then gave him the sentence immediately without even communicating with DS9.
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah, I think maybe like drop a couple of photons off from orbit before the Defiant takes him home. Just like, hey, fuck you.
I wonder if there's something to fear from them. If the Agrathis have this sort of technology, I wonder if they're someone you don't want to fuck with militarily.
Yeah, unclear, because it seems like what he was like there on a like on a friendly mission and just asked the wrong questions.
Yeah. Yeah, he seemed too curious, and that was they took great umbrage with that.
O'Brien's first stop is with the doctor, who actually greets him getting off the runabout.
Chief.
Julian.
And the doctor is interested in doing something to kind of unburden the chief of these memories, because nobody on Deep Space Nine thinks that it's fair what happened to him, and they'd like to take this trauma off his shoulders if they can.
What they need is a Cybok, Ben.
Share your pain with me.
They need Cybok to take his pain away.
Yeah. Where's Cybok at these days? The Vulcans are very... Oh, no, didn't he die fighting...
Yeah, he fought God.
His arms were long enough to do it.
We get... the way the story is told is fairly unique for Deep Space Nine. We get flashbacks and vignettes.
Yeah, the first flashback we get is the doctor's asking, like, what was it like? Was there anyone there? And O'Brien's like, nope, nobody was there. I was alone the entire time. Smash cut to him being thrown into the cell, and like a McGrathy alien cellmate, Ichar, being really nice to him.
Yeah.
But you know, this is one of those things where, like, you got to beat the shit out of the first guy you meet in jail.
I'm cast a Troy!
The chief beats Ichar to death, and then the episode's over.
I'm cast a Troy!
For decades, we have always gotten the new fish thrown into a cell, and then it immediately being a life-threatening situation.
And that's happened several times in Star Trek.
Yeah. This is not Oz, you know? Like, this is the best possible cellmate you could possibly get. Ichar does not look at you and lick his lips. Ichar is not, like, doing push-ups in the corner, like, getting totally swole.
Right.
Ichar is, like, laughing at shit, and, like, he's affable and fun.
He's got, like, all of the strategies for, you know, doing the time and not letting the time do you. And he's willing to share that.
He is an emotional counterpoint to O'Brien in every way, because when we cut away from O'Brien in the present to Ichar in the past, you get serious, dour, shattered O'Brien cross-cut into this other character, which is not like that at all.
Eat this. It'll help you feel better.
And he seems like the perfect person to have to do a long stretch of time with.
Yeah.
The doctor finds that these memories are not really going to be easy to wipe away. He's like explaining to Keiko, like, this is not like a chip that they installed in his head that can just be removed. Like he really experienced this from his perspective.
Yeah.
And so this is going to be something that is likely to be a long-term aspect of his life from now on.
They establish right away that this is not correctable.
I thought it was interesting that the two characters that I wanted the most in this were Counselor Troy and Captain Picard.
Yeah.
Because Counselor Troy knows Miles from way back, and I felt like for all the lip service that is paid to the existence of a counselor on the station, I thought this would have been a great opportunity to bring a friendly and familiar face back to the show.
Same.
And Picard actually experienced something not terribly unlike this.
Yeah.
In Inner Light. Like, it obviously wasn't a punitive version of this, but like the idea of moving forward in life where you have a set of memories that didn't actually happen to your physical body, but are real memories to you, is something that I would have loved to hear Peace do rap with O'Brien about.
Picard's experience in Inner Light isn't even referred to obliquely, which is something that this show has not shied away from. Like, this show talks about TNG a lot and the missions that they went on, specifically O'Brien's involvement. And even in this episode, they talk about three instances from TNG where O'Brien has suffered trauma, because later on, like, Bashir tells Keiko, like, your husband has been through some shit. But he's been through shit before, and he's come out fine on the other side. It's just going to take some time. And he uses those examples.
Yeah. But yeah, the memories are there to stay. Bashir says, I could wipe these memories, but I would have to wipe all of his memories to do it. And a ship puts in at the station with a passenger that says, "Don't do it, Chief. I have heard tell that this doctor will attempt things like this from time to time. He's entirely willing to wipe a man's memory."
It's like the doctor has some kind of punch card for erasing patients' memories. Why does he seek to do this in such quantity?
Did he not swear an oath to do no harm?
It's shocking. Like, why is this always on the table for Bashir? Someone get Bashir away from the clip show device.
Get it away.
To be quite honest about it, I was in a pale.
Mr. Bucket,
I have to revert back to my liquid state. I don't use the bucket anymore.
It's about this time in the episode that O'Brien starts seeing visions of HR. And right. It's to the viewer at this point, it is unclear whether or not HR is real or a figment. Because O'Brien treats him as a real person.
Right. He's having a real reaction. And it's that thing where sometimes HR is there and O'Brien sees him in place of a person who's actually there. Like when he and Keiko first see each other, O'Brien thinks it's HR initially. But then other times, like, he's just like chasing HR around the station and unable to you know, locate him or whatever.
Right.
But yeah, so the fam is there for him and wants to, like, Keiko really wants to help him deal with this, but it, like, he spent a lot of this episode in his civilian clothes, and it seems like he's been given all the time he needs to cope with this, and it is a really rough transition for him. Like, they have like a family dinner where he's like subdividing his food and squirreling it away in a napkin.
Miles.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing?
There's a scene where he's like sleeping on the hard floor because he's not used to a bed.
There's the scene where he's drinking toilet wine that he made himself.
Yeah, he goes to Quirk's bar and orders a toilet wine, and they're like, "We have good stuff too. Like, you don't have to have Pruno, Chief." And he's like, "It's all I drink anymore."
Quirk gives him a Ziploc bag of Pruno with like chunks and a straw in it. Gross. Worf is like, "What is that?
Can I have one of those too?
give me the gallon size version of that, please."
A warrior Ziploc.
Wow. One of the things that this episode does best, and I don't think it's going to give away how much I like the episode at the end to say so, is the asymmetry in the relationship between Keiko, Molly, and Miles, because it hurts so bad to see Keiko and Molly love Miles and for Miles to be incapable of receiving that love in any way. Like, right. It is really well done, and it made me ache to see it because Keiko is so good to him and so patient, and Molly just doesn't understand what's happening. Molly's a little kid, and like, to just see an out of control guy react, like, to see someone reflect love with hate or fear is especially painful, and I thought that those scenes where we see that were particularly effective.
I agree. We spend maybe a third of the episode in these memories.
Yeah.
There's a lot of time spent between O'Brien and HR, you know, like when he's filling his napkin with food and Keiko asks him what the fuck. We go back to the cell and show, like, we see HR like showing him how to ration yourself because they were starving in this cell a lot of the time and couldn't, you know, when the guards would be feeding them was unpredictable and would occasionally go to long stretches of not receiving food.
This is an example of a war crime, and this is a thing that would seem actionable from the Federation, right?
Yeah, it does. It is weird that it's like
But because it's imaginary, yeah, like maybe it doesn't prescribe to those rules. It's a weird gray area.
Except for if the trauma is real, which it is, yeah. Like he experiences the trauma as real, like that's kind of the...
Yeah.
Like that's what you're trying to prevent when you make an agreement about not doing bad shit like this.
Yeah. Yeah, good point.
So, I don't know. I mean, I guess there are like psychological and physical consequences to war crimes. So if half of that equation is not on the table, maybe it's, I don't know. Like it makes you ask a bunch of questions like that. Like what and why is there no, like I think going to war might be an extreme reaction to this, but the Federation should be way more pissed. And I wished there was an element of this episode talking about like what measures would be taken to, help these Agrathi understand that that would not be an acceptable move going forward.
Like, Sisko,
is it just like a fool me once? Like, okay, well, we can't deal with those guys anymore.
There's a strange treatment of cultures here because. On the one hand, Sisko does not allow Worf to ritually murder Kern,
right.
But he seems to be a little more forgiving of the Agrathi culture in this case because it's just an embedded part of their society to administer punishment in this way.
Yeah, but strange that that's, I don't know, maybe there's a whole scene that's on the cutting room floor of them talking about like the diplomatic reaction to this.
It's weird how like very bad episodes evoke these questions and also very good episodes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. I mean, I think that this episode answers a lot more of the questions that it evokes than a bad episode would.
Yeah.
But that's definitely one question that I feel goes unanswered. Speaking of Sisko, he's not a major presence in the episode.
No, not at all.
I mean, he pops up a couple of times, but he's not like the...
He pops up when shit gets really bad. And then the middle third of this episode, it does, because it's not just O'Brien's inability to accept the love from his family. He starts really going off in public on Quark and on coworkers. He's sort of a loose cannon. And you just can't have that. He's disturbing the peace.
Everybody is rallying to try and help him. Like, Worf is trying to be like darts buddy with him.
To be honest, I don't feel much like playing myself.
Well, we could go kayaking in the holosuite.
Jake is trying to help him kind of reconnect with his knowledge of engineering by like quizzing him on what all the tools are in his toolbox.
A combination square, a hammer, a level for hanging up pictures and stuff like that, or even a little miter box for doing a little bit of trim work.
One thing I wondered during that scene was, like, do the prop masters know the names of all these props also? Like, is an ODN coupler the same object from episode to episode?
Oh, I bet that's someone's job.
Because, like, they call for shit like that all the time, and it's never, like, what these devices are doing is kind of anybody's guess, right?
It really is a toolbox full of dildos, though, right? Like, all of those tools basically look the same.
Yeah. Yeah, if he put that in his checked luggage, it would for sure get opened up because half of that shit would be vibrating.
Occasionally, it's an electric razor.
Did you think that there was like a yellow shirt that like checked his work in that one scene?
That's Munoz.
Good as new.
Oh yeah,
he's back. He was from that that episode where they were in the atmosphere of that poison planet. Remember?
Right.
When that unexploded torpedo went into the ship and Quark had to
disarm it with his little buddy.
Yeah.
That's a great call. It seems like he's kind of temporarily the boss and like gives O'Brien an attaboy. I wondered if O'Brien was going to like walk out of the scene and he was going to be like, Jesus, he really blew this and like fix it.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing about his performance, about Munoz specifically, is that there's something about his manner that indicates that, but we don't see it. Like,
yeah,
his treatment of O'Brien seems so neutral that, like, I was projecting something onto him that wasn't there.
Right. Yeah. You're like, why is he being so nice?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the catch?
What are you doing?
Exactly. This is where we come to understand, though, that that O'Brien has not really been pursuing any kind of treatment regimen. The agreement that he made with the doctor was that he's going to be doing like regular counseling 3 times a week, and
that's kind of a lot, right?
It is, but I think with something this heavy, that's not unheard of, you know.
Yeah.
And he hasn't been doing it. He hasn't been doing anything to process what he went through.
Yeah. What he's doing primarily is telling people he's okay and he wants to be left alone. And he's often screaming those words at people.
I've been there.
He explodes on Bashir for being the doctor slash friend in this case. And
yeah,
this,
I think it's a problem that they have such a close friendship outside of their like doctor-patient relationship.
Yeah.
Because I think it is very common when you're having a psychological problem of some kind to react negatively to the suggestion that you get help.
Yeah.
Like, I think somebody, like, because it comes freighted with some kind of condescension and some unfortunate social baggage, the
people
suggestion...
want agency too, right? Like, people want to come to those decisions on their own. They don't want to be told to do things.
Yeah.
Just generally.
Yeah. Right. But like, you know, if your arm is broken, you don't take the suggestion to go head to the hospital as a shaming suggestion. But unfortunately, when a psychological arm is broken, it is not uncommon. So
yeah,
I don't know. Like I thought that the character stuff about like the way O'Brien resists the help that is being offered to him was very, very true.
Yeah.
And it's about a character that is having a realistic reaction to something that unfortunately prolongs his own suffering.
Right.
Like that's one of the really confounding things about these types of issues.
It's a moment that makes O'Brien think of a time when he exploded in a similar way in his cell at Ichar.
Yeah.
This is the moment in the episode when I knew for sure that O'Brien would eventually kill him. At what point did you get there in your mind?
I guess I predicted it when I first saw Ichar.
Oh, it was much later for me then.
Just because I like the idea that he would not want anybody to know that he had a cellmate.
Yeah.
Was, and then we find out that he has a cellmate. That was kind of, it was either going to be that he killed Ichar or that Ichar was going to be his torturer, but that seemed pretty clearly not to be the case right off the bat.
Yeah.
So. But yeah, and O'Brien gets very physical with HR and vice versa in this scene. But it also seems like, you know, like when you're cooped up with somebody in a confined space for an extended period of time, that can be really stressful, you know?
Yeah.
That's why we never talk to each other off stage when we're on tour.
It's one of the rules. We always go through Rob.
Yeah.
Is there a go-between?
Yeah.
O'Brien, seeing that Pruno is not on the menu, assaults Quark.
Why don't you give me my drink, or I'll break every bone in your worthless little body.
And then sits down and has a real interaction with fake Ichar.
You're not real. You're just in my head.
And it's at that point that Ichar says that he's always been a figment of his imagination.
But I'm real to you, and that's all that matters.
And this further kind of muddies the water of what Ichar is and what he represents.
I mean, like, definitionally, of course, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, why is the chief seeing him here and now? Like, what is that?
Yeah.
what does that mean? And I think that the clue to this is that line at the beginning when he's first kind of coming out of his days on Agrith, and one of the jailers there that was part of administering this thing says, like, the punishment is specially tailored to each offender, like,
yeah.
So it seems like maybe this is an after image or even potentially still part of the punishment.
Yeah. Pretty brutal.
Yeah. So take the D back out there and drop a couple more photons off.
Yeah. I don't think they're done. Jeez. Sisko does reappear about this point in the story to discuss the incident with Bashir and Quark. This is not just an isolated thing. This is now becoming a pattern of behavior that Sisko can't abide. And so he relieves him of duty and orders him into a regimen of daily counseling.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the fact that it's a pattern is why. Like, I can totally understand being frustrated that a busy bartender is ignoring you.
Yeah.
Like, you don't assault that person, but...
O'Brien shouldn't have done that thing where he holds his money in his hand and just sort of flips it around. Like, you don't want to do that either, Miles.
Yeah. Like, the strategy is, like, tip really well and that bartender will come find you when you come back up to the bar. But, like, the bartender does not know it's an O'Brien episode. Like, you know, you have to make the bartender understand it's an O'Brien episode.
Pruno is also a very bartender.
Right. It takes a long time to make, you know, it's like, it's going to slow down their flow.
A lot of ingredients.
If it's a beer bar, you know, like, order a beer, you know, don't throw them a curveball.
It's very bartender intensive. I understand Quark wanting to maybe save that until after the rush.
If Quark had like a waxed mustache and a sleeve garter.
Yeah.
Order the most complicated Pruno you want. Yeah. Like, that's what he's there for. But that's not the kind of bar he's running.
No.
Morn.
Dear sweet. Morn.
Evening, everybody.
Morn.
Stop. Hammer time.
O'Brien is pissed. Pissed enough to throw his comm badge on the ground.
Yeah.
And he storms into the infirmary because the reason that he sees for all of his problems is Bashir.
Right. And Bashir, to his credit, maintains a very even and professional keel here. He's like, I am trying to help you. I understand that you're not well, but as your doctor and your friend, like, I cannot in good conscience let you, like, pretend that nothing happened to you. And this is when Ichar kind of appears over Bashir's shoulder, and in one fell swoop, O'Brien can announce to both of them, I don't want your help, and I don't want to be friends with you anymore. Like they can both potentially interpret that as being directed at them.
Yeah, friend breakup. Pretty brutal. You don't want that. And, I mean, to a certain degree, he's also broken up with Starfleet. Like, the throwing of the comm badge away signifies potentially the end of his career also.
Well, he's broken up with life, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he's fucking storming through the station. Like, Ichar is trying to talk him off the ledge. He goes home to try and seek refuge there and winds up being agitated to the extent of screaming his head off at Molly, which is, like, a very genuinely frightening scene. Like, Colin Meaney threads an amazing needle in this episode of tiptoeing right up to the edge of familial violence while, like, maintaining sympathy as a character. Like, you understand that he's having a bad reaction to a bad situation and that, like, he is ashamed of what he does. Like, it's a tricky scene, right? Because this could permanently make this a hateable character.
Right. I couldn't help but think of how difficult it has to be for a child actor to do a scene like this. Like, Hannah Hattay has got to sit for what has to be a couple of takes and be screamed at by an adult that you know in a certain context and have worked with before, but, you know, like, Hannah Hatte is tiny. How old is she in this show right now? Like
she's like 4 or 5 years old.
She's young enough to where I wonder how difficult this is to go through. Like, yeah. she's clearly can't be sophisticated enough to truly get it here. And that's got to be hard for both Colomini and her.
Right. It's a weird thing to have to portray on all sides. And, yeah. And it is not hard to imagine that those tears that Molly sheds are real, you know? And that's not a great feeling.
Yeah.
to watch, like, the idea that they might actually have done something that was traumatic for her. Like, hopefully you get like a satisfactory conversation between Colomini and Hannah Hatte, like, on the set, and say, like, what we're going to do is just for pretend and it's not real.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully, I don't know.
They're child actor handlers on set, like, whose role is to safeguard children from emotional trauma. I wonder to what degree one of those or several of those was deployed in a moment like this.
I wonder, like, that documentary, the What We Left Behind documentary.
Yeah.
One of the things they talk about is that the production schedule for this show was such that sometimes they were working like 18-hour days.
Yeah.
And it's always really amazing to me when I hear that about television production. I've never worked on a television show. I know people that have, and I know that that's somewhat commonplace.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a budget and schedule issue. You know, like, the beast needs to be fed. You need to get an episode done every week. So the constraints are not entirely economic, but they are somewhat economic.
Like, right.
If you had a lot more money, you could just have 25 more production days sprinkled throughout the year and like longer weeks to shoot each episode. And the toll that working like that must take on you as a, like, whether, no matter what side of the camera you're on, it's got to be pretty intense, right?
Yeah. I really can't imagine that week in and week out for months at a time.
That's what makes me really afraid that something like a scene like this would actually have been like entered into without considering the like fragile emotional lives of the people who are being asked to do it.
Yeah, I mean, and I think you're saying that specifically about Colomini because the rules are different for child actors. Like, there's no way she's on set for longer than, what, like 4 hours? I don't remember what the specific rule is, but...
Right. Which is why they often work with twins for little children.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I mean, this scene is super intense. It leaves a terrible taste in your mouth. And yet, I think that it is... You understand in it that O'Brien is having a breakdown, and
it's a taste in O'Brien's mouth that's so bad it can only be removed with a phaser beam.
Jesus Christ.
Because O'Brien goes to a cargo bay and just like destroys it with a wrench and then goes for the weapons locker in the rock bottom moment.
He's standing there getting ready to punch his own ticket, and the doctor comes down,
Chief,
and starts to try and kind of talk him off the ledge.
Get out of here, Julian.
And O'Brien says, like, I'm not doing this for myself. I'm doing it to protect all of you. Like, I came very close to getting violent in my own house. I don't feel like I'm in control anymore. And I feel like I have a track record of violence now that I can't protect you from. And the doctor's like, what? What do you mean, like a track record of violence? And he's like, well, you know, like, there's Ichar, of course. And the doctor says, who's Ichar? And O'Brien goes, he's right behind you. Ah! Because there's Ichar there in the cargo bay.
Bashir goes for the weapons locker and is like, I'll do it myself.
I'll finish what you started, Chief. I mean, it's still a figment that the doctor can't see, obviously, but the conversation keeps going, and they talk about how O'Brien came to to murder HR that were like very, very desperately hungry at a certain point. They'd gone over a week without being rationed any food by the prison. And I thought that this scene, the flashback was a little imperfect in my mind, because O'Brien kills HR and then finds the package of food that HR was hiding and is relieved by how much food is there, and is like, believes definitively that HR was definitely saving this food for both of them. Which I couldn't quite get there. I couldn't get to a point where HR had a secret secondary food stash that he wasn't telling the chief about, and that the chief would be utterly convinced that it was for both of them in that context.
Yeah, and especially because Miles seems uncertain about whether or not he'd killed HR when the sound of snapping chicken bones makes that fairly evident. Like, he does not seem traumatized by the idea that he just killed a person. But this might be just a glimpse at his broken pathology. Yeah. Like,
is he so delirious with hunger that he doesn't really have a firm grip on
That's how I read it. Yeah.
I guess that could go to explaining why he believes that HR was saving the food for both of them also.
You're treated to just a 3-minute montage of O'Brien going to town on this food. Eating and eating until he makes himself sick.
It's like the heroin scene in Wet Hot American Summer.
Yeah.
It's always fun to get away from camp, even for an hour.
You really want to do this? Here, now, okay, let's do it!
Bashir, having learned of the significance of this, makes the case that one moment doesn't define a life. A bad moment can't destroy a good person.
And a bad bit moment can't destroy a comedy podcaster.
Yeah. Boy, are we lucky that's true.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people aren't aware that this is a comedy podcast. So.
Yeah. I think most people would be pretty confused by that. O'Brien.
You really should never have categorized this as comedy. That is not how it is understood in the world.
O'Brien gets it. Bashir's counseling works better than anyone's.
It's smart that Bashir takes the self-hate is an example of your evolution tactic.
Yeah.
Because that's something that O'Brien is here for. He's like, oh, yeah, I do really hate myself.
Yeah, because you're never going to remove the self-hate from the equation. You just need to redirect that energy into something that works. And that's
not
what
you,
Bashir's
I hate,
able-
HR. It's what killing you made me become.
Yeah. Yeah, and that works, and it makes HR disappear. After appearing to forgive O'Brien for murdering him in a cell over a couple of scraps of food, HR very forgiving.
The disappearance seemed like dramatic enough that it felt like it might have been an intentional part of the program that the Agrathi installed in him.
Oh. Oh, shit, man. I didn't even consider that was like part of his like punishment journey. Like, that's part of the programming, you think?
I don't think that the episode says that explicitly. It just, I wondered it when in watching it.
I would like to believe that this show was sophisticated enough to do that. So I'm going to choose to believe it.
Yeah.
That's pretty great.
The button on the episode is the doctor giving the chief a hypo spray. He's going to be slamming Wellbutrin intravenously going forward. And meeting with the counselor, the idea that these memories can be extracted is totally off the table. So it's going to be about learning to live with them, but he's going to be taking something that kind of dulls the edge of that.
Yeah.
And then he returns home and finds a loving family that is excited to see him.
Daddy's home! Daddy's home!
Molly ain't holding no grudges.
Yeah, they've forgiven.
It would be pretty intense if she was, though, right? Like, he leans down to hug her and she says, "It's not you I hate, Daddy. It's what you made me become."
Oh, no. She just runs away screaming. Which would be an understandable reaction. Yeah. A really positive ending to a fairly dark episode, Ben. Did you like it?
I did like the episode. I feel like it is an example of an episode that sets a pretty high bar for itself in terms of what it's going to try and deal with.
Yeah.
Like the emotional truth of what it's going to deal with is going to be pretty intense. I feel lucky not to have any PTSD-based psychological problems because they seem really, really tough. And I know a couple of people that do have like that kind of, you know, struggle with those kind of demons, and I don't envy it at all. But I think that you can trust Colm Meaney to take this really seriously and give it a performance that is very true, not only to the kind of condition that his character is in, but the way his character would experience that condition. And I think he really rises to that challenge. What about you?
Yeah, I really agree. I think it's easy to compare this episode to Inner Light and turn it into kind of a Black Mirror Inner Light for O'Brien. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And, you know, Picard was so instructive about how Starfleet officers, like the stoicism of a Starfleet officer giving way to an acceptance of awful circumstances and like the breakdown that that he gave his character permission to have. And I was wondering whether or not Colm Meaney would take O'Brien that far in that direction. And interestingly, he doesn't. Like, he doesn't have the breakdown in the Field of Grapes after Best of Both Worlds. Like, he does not have the total collapse.
Yeah.
And that's because Miles O'Brien isn't like that. Like, he's a soldier who's been to war in a way that Picard hasn't. And I like how hard he fought to maintain before finally breaking. Like, I thought that was true to what we know about him. I mean, I felt like in a lot of ways this was the biggest and smallest episode of DS9 so far. Like,
yeah.
Because it really exploded those feelings of what this kind of trauma must be like, and but put it inside of maybe one of the most well-liked DS9 characters on the show. And their ability to do that and do it effectively, I thought, is what made it great. I'm curious about to what degree they will be able to maintain any callbacks to this episode at all. Like,
yeah.
This being the type of show that it is, it shows at times a willingness to do those kind of callbacks, but this has the potential to change him forever. I wonder if that's a consequence of it.
Yeah, I mean, it feels a lot like the time that Geordi got abducted by the Romulans and tortured. And, you know, they mention at the end of this episode, like, this is going to take like a lot of really hard work in therapy to unburden yourself of the trauma of this, or learn to live with the trauma of this, or whatever.
Yeah.
And then it's just like the next episode, he's like, hey, I'm Geordi. I'm the same guy.
You know what's weird is like Star Trek really wants to engage with these serious issues a lot. And I think, you know, we're at a point in society right now where therapy is destigmatized in such a way that it's like talked about in a really great way, in an open and honest way. But
yeah, I think it has a long way to go still.
Sure.
Like, there's still plenty of people that are like, you know, that's great for other people, but that's not me.
My point is that for as progressive as Star Trek is, it only ever depicted therapy in a Barclay context. And Barclay was in there for social reasons in a way that I think to have sprinkled Geordi into the counselor's office, or Picard into the counselor's office, or in the future of Deep Space Nine, put O'Brien in counseling going forward would have been a far more progressive way to demonstrate a therapist necessity in instances like these. But
yeah,
it's a
hard thing to depict because it's one of those things that, you know, you try and go in for an hour a week and the changes are fairly incremental, and that's not that dramatic of a thing to show.
Yeah.
Like, you occasionally have the therapy session where you're shredded and ugly crying on the couch and your therapist is getting up to hand you the box of tissues, but a lot of the time it's just like trying to remember what your childhood was like or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I don't know. Yeah, a tricky thing to do. I think this is a great episode and a very special one.
Yeah, I do too. I feel the same way. Good stuff.
Do you want to see if we have any priority one messages, Adam?
Yeah, let's see if any of our priority one messages are as good as this episode. I'm gonna challenge them right now.
Wow, fuck.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental. Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Adam, we have a couple of priority one messages here. The first one is of a commercial nature, and it goes like this. If you run a web design, development, app, PR, or marketing agency, you know sales is often the hardest part. Good work is the best business development, but hope is not a plan. That Was Clutch consults with agencies to help them level up their business development practices, close more proposals, generate more leads, buy more yamek sauce. Also, a non sequitur Ro Laren mentioned. Because that's a sick drop and we don't get to hear it enough.
Yeah, fair.
So please visit thatwasclutch.com to learn more and make first contact. And then parenthetically, I'm sorry.
Wow. That's great.
That's awesome. I, like, as a semi-retired small business owner of a film production company that I never did enough to develop new business with, that's the kind of business that I absolutely needed, like somebody to talk to me about what business development could look like for a company like mine and what I could and should be doing to you know, help myself grow my business.
Right. Yeah, That Was Clutch is based out of Philadelphia. I'm checking out their website now. Pretty cool. Yeah.
And you get to work with Friends of DeSoto to expand your business.
I mean, that's the best part, right?
Right. They know about the road drop at That Was Clutch.
Know all about it.
Do we have any other priority one messages, Adam?
Sure do, Ben. This one is of a personal nature. It is from Favorite Big Brother, and the spelling of favorite would indicate to me that this could be from a north of the border person.
Oh, yeah. A Canadian or a British Big Brother is what you're talking about?
Yeah, potentially. And the message is for favorite.
I guess Australians probably spell it like that, too.
Yeah.
New Zealanders.
This one's going out to Favorite Whittle Sister. Message goes like this. Happy birthday, Whittle Sister. Even though we're separated across the whole continent, I'm always thinking of you. I'm glad we can share in watching the pod and the shows that go along with it. Hope you can come visit me someday in NYC. Thanks, Ben and Adam, for the pod. It's a great watch every week.
Man, I thought for sure that we were thinking Canadians, and now that one of them is in NYC, it could be a brother and a sister from anywhere.
Yeah, I mean,
that
both happen to
be on the North American continent.
What is it called when you add the U instead of just the favorite with only the O? Does that have a designation? Is there a term for that?
Yeah, I believe it's an imperial standard.
Oh, yeah, this feels like stolen imperial standard. if you're coming out of NYC, huh?
Yeah. Unless you are from another part of the Anglosphere where they didn't change all the spellings during the Revolutionary War.
Happy birthday, Whittle Sister, from Ben and me, too.
Yeah, from us, also. If you'd like to send a Priority One message, it's really easy. You head to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It's $100 for a personal message, $200 for a commercial message, and we really appreciate them.
Get that gold press lock. Get that
gold press lock.
Am I right? Yeah. Am I right?
Every morning when I hop out of bed, I get
a couple of capsules of my Ritual multivitamin and a capsule of my Ritual Symbiotic Plus probiotic. I pop them in my mouth, wash them down with a bunch of water, and I know I've taken vitamins and supplements that are going to get my body off to a good start. And these are rigorously tested and validated by third parties for allergens, microbes, and heavy metals. And they use scientific tools to select lower carbon packaging, prioritize sustainably sourced ingredients, and set ambitious climate goals. The Essential for Men is the quality multivitamin that I take from a company you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/scarves. Start Ritual or add Essential for Men to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/scarves for 25% off.
I've got to fly cross country to visit our buddy Adam Ragusea today, and there have already been 2 flight delays on the outbound. And as I watch the delays get longer and my travel day get thrown into a shambles, I'm remaining chill. There's nothing I can do but wait, and I'm making my waiting a little better with a microdose gummy. That's because microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help me feel just the right amount of good. We've all seen those videos of people going crazy on airplanes. Well, this isn't that kind of dose at all. This is the kind of dose that makes a long delay at an airport feel a little more bearable. There are all kinds of other uses, and if you've ever considered microdosing, I'd encourage you to give the products from Lumi Labs a try. Get 30% off your first order plus free shipping today at microdose.com using the promo code SCARVS. Now, these products are available nationwide, and that URL is microdose.com. The promo code is SCARVS. And with that, you can save 30% and free shipping. Again, that's microdose.com, and the promo code is SCARVS.
Hi, this is Biz, and this is the final season of One Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting. This is going to be a year of celebrating all that makes this podcast and this community magical.
I'm so glad that I found your podcast.
I just cannot thank you enough for just being the voice of reason as I'm trying to figure all of this out.
Thank you, and cheers to your incredible show and the vision you had to provide this space for all of us.
This is still a show about life after giving life. And yes, there will be swears. You can find us on MaximumFun.org. And as always, you are doing a great job.
All right, class. Tomorrow's exam will cover the science of cosmic rays, the morals of art forgery, and whether or not fish can drown. Any questions? Yes, you in the back.
What is this?
It's the podcast Let's Learn Everything,
where we learn about science and a bit of everything else. My name's Tom. I study cognitive and computer science, but I'll also be your teacher for intermediate emojis.
My name's Caroline, and I did my master's in biodiversity conservation, and I'll be teaching you intro to things the British Museum stole.
My name's Ella. I did a PhD in stem cell biology, so obviously I'll be teaching you the history of fan fiction.
Class meets every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
So do I still get credit for this?
No.
Obviously not.
No.
It's a podcast.
Hey, Adam.
What's that been?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible.
Drunk Shimoda!
Ben, I don't know if I've ever done this before. Maybe I have and I just don't remember. Maybe I have and I wanted to forget. But I am going
Did Bashir wipe your personality?
I'm going to abstain from a Shimoda this episode. I thought this ep was so serious and so dark that very little was enjoyable to me in the context of the selection of a Shimoda. And I racked my brain about it. Like, I guess I came pretty close with Quark, but Quark was the victim of an assault. And like, that wasn't a fun scene. And I came close to giving it to Worf for like not knowing how to play darts but still wanting to play darts. Like, that's how he comforts his friend O'Brien in this case. But like, nothing edged close enough to, and we've watched a lot of dark episodes before, Ben, and I've always found a way to find a Shimoda, but I just couldn't. And maybe yours will inspire me to daily double it, but I can't do it. I'm not going to do it.
Okay. Well,
what about you?
I guess I will either feel like an asshole or you will copy me.
I'll copy you.
Because I do
you,
have
Ben.
A Shimoda.
What do you got?
I did get close to Quark, but it wasn't Quark. It was the Bolian that was sitting at the bar next to O'Brien when O'Brien assaulted Quark. Because instead of like intervening or attempting to help Quark or do anything, like this is happening essentially in this Bolian's lap.
Yeah.
When Quark gets his ear grabbed and gets pulled over the bar.
This is some of the fun of sitting at the bar. Like you get a lot of the interplay between bartender and customer, but occasionally it goes wrong.
He just sits there. He just like he treats it as up close entertainment.
You telling like, me you wouldn't just sit there? I feel like I would be shocked enough to just sit there.
I would move breakable objects and sharp things out of the way, and I would get in there. I would do my best to separate these two men.
This is my glass. I'm just gonna move my glass.
So that Bolian is my drunk Shimoda for not doing that situation right, and also like the. Like by extension, the entire like it's a crush at the bar,
yeah.
And nobody does anything to help Quark. Like nobody lifts a finger.
Good Shimoda. Well, Ben, what do we have coming up on the next episode? It can't possibly be this dark, right?
The next episode is season 4, episode 19, "Shattered Mirror." Sisko follows his son into a war-torn alternate universe after Jake is lured there by the living counterpart of his late mother. Oh, wow. It's a Jennifer Sisko episode.
And
mirror Jennifer Sisko.
And it is dark.
Yeah, it's going to be dark. But mirror universe is like corny dark. Not like deep psychological truths dark.
It's like purple corn. We get a purple corn episode. Great.
Yeah.
Great. How are we going to watch it, though?
That's a good question. I suppose I'll head to gach.biz/game, where our legendary board game is kept, and we will find out how we will be watching it.
We recently slid back down to the first row of the game, didn't we?
Yes. We are currently on square 8. We have a Coco No-No and a Fuck It, We'll Do It Live close into the runabout. Those are the squares we could hit, potentially.
All right.
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
Oh, man. And I have, in fact, hit a Fuck It, We'll Do It Live.
What?
Which I think is the first time we've done this. This is one where it requires us to live stream the recording of the show.
Wow.
But yeah, that will be the next episode, one way or another. And I guess you'll have the option to watch us record it live in some way via the internet. Hey, gang, quick production note. We already did the live broadcast of season 4, episode 19. We did a live YouTube the other day, and it was really fun, but, you know, in the spirit of it being live and kind of as we record, it was just available while we were doing it. If you missed it and are super intensely curious to see what we look like while we're casting pod for some reason, we do have the video saved, and we're thinking about dropping it on the MaximumFun.org donors only page sometime after the episode in question drops. So sometime next week, check back there, and that'll probably be where it winds up living.
Looking forward to it in whatever form that takes. Just as I look forward to wrapping up the show, Ben, by thanking our legion of supporters and viewers.
It is because of your generous support that we are able to do this show. The folks that head to MaximumFun.org/donate and contribute on a monthly basis make this show possible. And it's not for nothing. They get access to all of our bonus content, of which there's quite a lot. And even when it's not the Max Fun Drive, there are prizes for becoming a monthly contributor. So head to MaximumFun.org/donate if you've been thinking about it, and get it done right now.
Yeah. Don't even think about it. And by that, I mean think about it and go do it.
Yeah. Like, think about it while you're doing
it. It's a statement of immediacy is what I'm trying to say.
Right. We should also thank all the folks who have left a nice review for the program on their podcatcher of choice or recommended the show to a friend. If you'd like to check out some of the great artwork that is created surrounding the show, including the trading cards that Bill Tilly makes every week or the poster that J.J. Lendl makes every week, search the hashtag GreatestGen on Twitter. Adam's on there at CutForTime. I'm on there at BenjaminAHR. Don't use Facebook. There's also a subreddit and the Wikia, where all the jokes are gone into in great detail.
My podcatcher of choice is Overcast, and it allows you to make and share clips of the shows you like. If you like a part of this show or any of the other shows that we've made, share a clip.
That helps. That's a really cool.
That helps get people interested in the show. I can dig
cool
that.
Cool function.
Yeah.
We should thank the great Adam Ragusea, who made all of the custom theme music for this show, and Dark Materia, who made the original theme song for the show, which you can hear, potted down, but below my voice right now.
Unclear whether or not Dark Materia is a great home cook, but we know that about Adam Ragusea, and we will soon know that even better after we make a delicious dinner of beef burger. That's going to be a special ep, right?
Yeah, he's probably going to like take our voiceover and throw it right in the garbage and do his own.
Yeah, yeah, he's love those vocal stylings. Can't beat it. With that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine, which is clearly purple corn.
It's the Oaxacan style corn, right?
Yeah.
Oaxacan quesadilla made with a blue corn tortilla.
You know, if this mirror universe episode is confusing, you could call it a kind of a maze, couldn't you? So a purple corn maze, but maybe maze like the Native Americans called it. Yeah? That's what I think. That's what I think they could call it. Right?
Well, nobody's going to hear that episode because they will hear this and realize what a fucking waste of time this show is.
You reach for the weapons locker, grab the dustbuster from inside, place it into your mouth.
Yeah.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.